Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 30th, 2016, and this is show number 599. Well, we've been building up to the 600th episode of the No Silly Cast, but then I realized that next week, I'm going to be in an area with no internet access on the day of the live show. Heck, even Sandy won't be in town, so, you know, why bother doing a live show then? So, two things are going to happen. First of all, the show will be out early next week because, you know, we never miss a show. I'm thinking probably Thursday. And there will be no live show on November 6th. So to everybody who likes to come to the live show, don't show up on November 6th. So I won't even be able to go into the chat room to tell you why I'm not there because we're not going to have any internet. But here's the thing. I don't want to do a 600th show without a live audience. So I've decided to just skip over 600 and declare next week's show 601. Then the following week, I'll do a show 600. How's that to mess with your head? Now, I do have to confess that I stole this idea from the SMR podcast guys. They weren't all in town for episode 300, so they just skipped right past it. And they said they were going to come back and do it, but I'm pretty sure they forgot to ever come back and do episode 300. By the way, there is a way to keep track of when the live shows are. If you copy the link, I put it in the show notes here, but it's also at podfeet.com/live. You don't click on this link, copy it, and it goes to the Google Calendar for the No Silly Cast. You can use it to subscribe inside your calendar of choice. It's a .ics link. Anyway, whenever I cancel a live show or I move it, you'll see that correctly in the calendar. Anyway, let's get on with show number 599. Well, speaking of messed up show numbers, this week's Chit Chat Across the Pond was episode 461, but you'll hear me say 460 in the show. I do not know why it's so hard for me to get the Chit Chat Across the Pond numbers right, but I mess it up probably every third week. In any case, it was a fun-filled episode with Bart Bouchatz, back with Programming by Stealth Installment 24, Creating a JavaScript API. He also teaches us an easy way to create professional documentation in order to publish our work as a JavaScript library, because apparently we're going to have published work soon. In order to get there, though, we had to learn how to write reusable and shareable code, how closures help you keep your variables out of the global scope so they don't mess up other people's code. We learned one ternary operator and, my favorite, self-executing anonymous functions. If that sounds fun to you, check out Chit Chat Across the Pond, episode 461, and of course, the spectacular show notes over at bartbouchatz.ie. This week, Apple released iOS 10.1, which included the beta of the new portrait mode for the iPhone 7 Plus. Portrait mode applies what they call a depth effect, blurring things in the background while keeping the focus sharp on faces in the foreground. The effect is limited to the 7 Plus because it uses the dual cameras to produce this effect. Two lenses and a lot of math. Now, I'm a huge fan of portrait photography, so this effect was a big contributor to my decision to go with the 7 Plus. Spoiler, I love portrait mode. I've taken dozens of portraits so far of adults and children, and the crisp focus on people's faces really makes them pop out of the photos. Like the HDR mode on iPhones, you get two copies of every photo. One is a normal image, and the second has the depth effect. Having the two side by side really highlights the advantages of using portrait mode, and it's kind of fun to flick back and forth and see what changed. For example, I took a shot of my grandson Forbes in Lindsay's arms. In the normal shot, there's this stupid outlet just to the left of his head that really distracts from his adorable face. The depth effect image blurs that stupid outlet, so it looks a lot better. Another example was when I took a shot of Steve outside when I was testing, and I didn't notice that there was a leaf from a tree sticking out from behind his head. In the normal shot, it looks terrible, definitely a throwaway shot, but with the blurred background in the portrait shot, it's not actually distracting. Now, when you start to take a photo in portrait mode, you'll get some on-screen clues of what to do. If you're the correct distance from your subjects, it can find any faces in view. Portrait mode will put a little box around those faces and try to focus on them. If you're too close to your subjects, it will say, move farther away, or place subject within 8 feet if you're too far away. Portrait mode will also tell you if it's too dark to pull off the effect. Also of note is that it uses the smaller field of view of the zoom lens, which is 56 millimeter equivalent, but we're so used to the wide angle lens that it feels like you're way zoomed up. So you'll start to take a picture and you'll go, ooh, I got to back up. One of the immediate temptations is to test this mode on something other than faces. Now, they told you it's beta and it works on faces, but that's not what you're going to do. Now, remember, I said it takes a lot of math to pull this off, right? Well, that math includes focusing on the eyes, nose, and the mouth of humans. So, of course, I took a picture of our dog Tessa first thing. I thought it worked surprisingly well. Then I tested it on a creepy Halloween doll sitting next to this creepier rat. The doll was focused appropriately, but the rat had too much depth to his face for the math to work properly. Now remember, this is not designed for rats, dogs, or dolls, but the doll actually had a face, so I think that's why it worked pretty well. I was pleased with the depth effect from portrait mode, but I thought it might be fun to do a direct comparison to an equivalent lens on a DSLR. Now, a true portrait lens is the 35mm equivalent of 90 to 130mm, but that lens size would be distinctly different from the field of view that we're going to get from the iPhone, and I wanted to get as close as I could to that iPhone's lens as possible. So I borrowed Lindsay's Nikon D40 DSLR and her 50mm f1.8 lens. I knew that the iPhone's 56mm lens was f2.2, so I put her camera in aperture priority and set it to f2.2. So I figured these would be pretty close, 50mm equivalent and 56mm equivalent, both set to f2.2. I chose Steve as my subject and put him in front of some ivy and a white garage door. He was wearing a white and gray shirt, and we made sure he wasn't in bright sunlight. I took several photos and got two, one on each camera, that were framed just about the same. The first interesting observation was that the lens information from the iPhone 7 Plus image was not what I thought it would be. Remember, I told you it was a 56mm lens, f2.2. Apple creates this depth effect using both of its lenses, and when it combines them, the resulting image, at least in this example, turned out to be f2.8 and 57mm, not 56. In other portrait mode images I took, the f-stop and equivalent focal length were distinctly different. Interesting, but I figured this would still be close enough for me to compare to the DSLR. I opened the images from the two cameras and adjusted the exposure, saturation, and aspect ratios until they were comparable, cropping one of them so they looked about the same. I didn't want those things to distract in a direct comparison. So I put the two images in the show notes, and you can click on them to see them in full resolution. Then I enlisted a few of my photography buddies to look at these two images. I told them I preferred they not look at the EXIF data to learn anything about the images, but to tell me which camera took which photo and to critique the two. Bart Bouchat, Stephen Getz, Alistair Jenks, Mark Pauly, and Victor Cahiao all jumped in to talk about the comparison of the photos. Because they're photographers, they all explained up front that they could easily tell which camera took which photo. And after they pointed out, now I can see it a mile away too. Bart explained it really well. He said that while the background blur from the iPhone 7 Plus is very pleasing, on a real lens-created blur, anything bright in the background should look like a large, out-of-focus version of whatever shape the lens aperture has. Once he said that, I remembered seeing blurred-out Christmas lights that looked like hexagons. Now when I look at the two cameras' images, I can clearly see that the one with the flatter blur is from the iPhone, and the one from the DSLR, you can see these little tiny hexagons. Well, Bart did some serious pixel peeping, and he pointed out several areas where you could tell the errors in the math from the iPhone. There's a couple of spots where Steve's white shirt is against a bright leaf, and it has a small distortion right at those connection points. Another thing he noticed, and the other guy said, wow, that is pretty obvious once you pointed out, his beard isn't all in focus, even though it's the same distance from the camera as say, his eyes. So it didn't quite pick that up correctly. There's also a vertical gutter that goes down behind his head, and it's oddly in focus between, say, his ear and his neck. So above it's out of focus, but between his ear and his neck, it's not in focus. So once you notice that, you're like, wow, that looks really weird. But again, I didn't notice any of these right off. From these criticisms, you'd think the iPhone 7 Plus image looked awful, but Bart and the others did say that it took some looking to be that critical. They said the effect was surprisingly well done. Now, remember, this is in beta, and for a first cut, it's pretty astonishing. After talking to the guys, I took a more critical eye to the photos I'd taken earlier, and I could see the same kind of small imperfections in them, too. I noticed the main place you can see it seems to make mistakes is with hair. Often the edges, around the edges of somebody's head, their hair will be out of focus when other parts of their face should be in focus. If you're hearing this and not reading it in the blog, I've put quite a few images in the blog post, including the full resolution versions I mentioned of the DSLR comparison of Steve, so you can see that effect for yourself. Bottom line, I am thrilled with the new Portrait Mode Depth Effect because it creates images that highlight the faces of the people I love. The iPhone 7 Plus is now the favorite camera I own. As I'm sure you've all heard, Apple updated the MacBook Pro line this week. The big excitement is that they've replaced the function keys with an OLED touchscreen they've named Touch Bar. They added Touch ID to the right side of the Touch Bar as well. They got rid of the mechanical trackpad, replacing it with a force touch trackpad that's twice as big as the old one. Well, I guess the most recent one did have a touch trackpad, but it was kind of crammed into the same size as the old mechanical one, so now they've got the great big one. The list goes on and on of all the improvements they've made. I'm not going to go through everything, but I'd like to walk through some of these improvements. Specifically, I want to talk about the 15-inch model and give you my take on these improvements. I'd like to start with the price, because I'm hearing a lot of complaints about that. I dug out my receipt for my late 2013 MacBook Pro. By the way, I keep all my receipts and images of my items in home inventory from Binary Formations, if you're interested. And I wanted to do a comparison to today's price. My philosophy with computers has always been to buy the second to the top of the line. If there's just three choices, I always take the middle one. But a lot of times what you'll find is that last little boost you get of maybe 1 to 2 tenths of a gigahertz and maybe a smidge more in graphics always costs way more than I think it's worth. So in 2013, I bought the 2.3 gigahertz Intel Core i7. I could have gone for 2.6 gigahertz, but instead I bumped the RAM up to 16 gig and the SSD to 1 terabyte. The second to the top of the line MacBook Pro cost me $3,099 before tip and tax and Apple Care. 3 years later, the 2016 MacBook Pro in the second to the top of the line configuration with 16 gigs of RAM and a 1 terabyte SSD is $2,999 before tip and tax and Apple Care. So this model is $100 cheaper than the same configuration in 2013. Now, I don't want you to think I'm implying by any means that this is an inexpensive computer. You're talking to a woman who paid $2,800 for her first car. So this is an expensive computer, but it's less expensive than it was 3 years ago. And that's without taking inflation into account. But here's the problem. They offered a 2 terabyte disk option. And Steve said I should go for it. Well, I wasn't going to do it, but, you know, there he was egging me on. What could I do? And then I realized later, remember the long drawn-out saga I had of how I moved my photos library off disk onto an external SSD because they no longer fit on my 1 terabyte internal drive? Well, they're coming back on board now. So I actually, after I did the nuke and pave, it turns out I have a lot of free disk space. It's amazing. Out of a 1 terabyte drive, I have 700 gigabytes free right now. So I thought, all right, maybe I'll migrate my photos back right now before I get the new machine. And since I just did a nuke and pave, I don't feel bad about doing migration assistant. But I moved the photos back and then I told Photos, okay, make this my system photo library. And it said, yeah, you know, you don't have enough disk space on this machine to make this your system photo library with the originals. You need to do optimized photos. And luckily, I had heard that this could happen on Dave Hamilton's and Dave Hamilton was talking about it on the Mac Geek Gab with John F. Braun. Somebody wrote in about it and he said, yeah, you got to tell it to optimize because it thinks you're moving photos in. It's not smart enough somehow to notice that they're already there, which makes zero sense to me. So for the past 3 days, I have been yet again migrating all of my data up to the cloud. Again, or back down from the cloud, I don't know, making optimized images locally. So it's actually about, I think it's maybe close to 100 gigabytes free of my, or done of my 460 gigabytes. So hopefully by the time I go on my trip, it'll be done doing that. And then guess what I have to do? I have to tell it to bring the full size images back. So anyway, I'm getting all that done before the new machine gets here. All right. But enough talking about the price and the 2 terabyte drive. Let's talk about this, what this Mac has to offer, and talk through whether maybe it might be something you want. First of all, people love to talk about ports. If there's one, they want two. If they get two, they say it's the wrong two. If they take one away, everybody gets angry. It makes sense, though, because what you need is what you need, right? It's what you need. That's what actually matters. It doesn't matter whether I need that. It matters whether you need it. In the older MacBook Pros, we had a plethora of ports. The 2013 had 2 Thunderbolt ports, 2 USB, 1 MagSafe power port, and an HDMI port, a headphone jack, and an SD card slot. Well, the new MacBook Pro has 4 Thunderbolt 3 ports. That's a port that is the size and shape of USB-C. And it's actually, Dave Hamilton put this well on another episode of the show. He said that think about Thunderbolt 3 ports as being like PCIe slots in an old PC where you could add cards to it. So we'll get more to what we're going to do with that later. But anyway, the new MacBook Pro has four Thunderbolt 3 ports and a headphone jack, and that's it. Now, that might sound bad to you, but let's think about this. On the 2013, I never once used the HDMI port. In fact, I didn't even know it was there for over a year after I had it until somebody pointed it out. Shows you how much I pay attention. It took up space internally and in thickness, and it never provided me any value. But maybe you really needed HDMI, and it was the most valuable port on your Mac. Well, with the four Thunderbolt 3 ports on the new model, you can make them into anything you want. Just like those PCIe slots, you can add anything you want. If you want it to be four USB-A ports, you can do that. If you want power on the right-hand side of your laptop instead of the left-hand side, these ports can do that. If you want a USB hub, an SD card reader, a Thunderbolt display, and Ethernet, you can have that. It is completely configurable to what you need and want. Now, this comes at a price, of course, and that's in the purchase and use of dongles. At $25 to $30 each, this can start to add up. But let's say you need the configuration we just described, and tomorrow you need them to be all four USB-A ports. With enough dongles, you can make that happen where you couldn't before. I think the flexibility outweighs the dongle tax. Let's talk about the trackpad. I'm a huge fan of the Force Touch trackpad in the MacBook. On the traditional trackpads, clicking on them just really bugged me. I don't know if it's because I felt like that mechanical switch was going to wear out like it did on one of my external Apple trackpads, or if it was just the sound, but I hated it. The first thing I would do with the new Mac was to turn on two-finger tap to select. But with the Force Touch trackpad on the MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook I'm talking about, the one I bought last year, it's a delight to click. If you haven't ever played with Force Touch trackpads, it's really pretty magical. One of my favorite party tricks is to let someone click away on it while I power down the Mac. They're always astonished when the power finally goes off and the trackpad stops clicking. It's unbelievable that it's not actually a mechanical click. It's really amazing. It's fun to do to people. So here's another big seller for the Force Touch trackpad. A classic failure of the Mac notebooks is the trackpad is if the battery starts to swell. I had seen that happen to other people, and of course it happened to mine just last month. Maybe it's a good thing, though, as an early warning system about the battery. Yeah, I don't know, I'll have to think about that. Well, I'm not sure why the trackpads are so much bigger, though. The external Magic trackpad from Apple is huge compared to the older mechanical one, and I love it. So I guess having a bigger trackpad in the MacBook Pro will be good, too. I'm just not sure why it needs to be bigger, but it works well being big on the ones I've seen. One thing I never liked about the 2013 MacBook Pro was the distance from the keys to the edge of the laptop where your wrist rests. It was just short enough that my watch always caught on the edge or scratched around on the surface and kind of bugged my wrist. With my traditional elegant watches, I always had to take them off to use the MacBook Pro in my lap. The MacBook is small enough that it never bugged me at all, even with a much bigger Apple Watch. I'm curious about the dimensions on the new MacBook Pro. I really hope it's smaller so my watch doesn't scratch on it. Maybe this is just me, but a couple people answered on the blog that they thought that they had the same problem. Now, the keyboard on the new MacBook Pro is the second generation of the butterfly keys. I have kind of a love-hate relationship with the first-gen butterfly keys on the 12-inch MacBook. It's part of why the MacBook is so thin and light, and the keys are low stress on my hand, so that's all good. But I definitely have more typos with the MacBook than I do with the Magic Keyboard I use with my MacBook Pro when it's on my desk. The Magic Keyboard is my favorite keyboard of all time. Of any Mac keyboard or PC keyboard I have ever owned, the Magic Keyboard is the one I like the best. So I'm hopeful that the second generation butterfly keys will be more accurate for touch typists, but I don't know. Might be still worth it. We'll see. Now, the only thing you interact with more on a laptop if you're sighted than the keyboard is the display. The new MacBook Pro display is supposed to be 67% brighter, have a 67% higher contrast ratio, and have a color depth increase of 25%. Now, I don't know if I'm going to notice the last two, but brighter is always better for me. The brighter a display, the more your pupils contract, and the smaller your pupils are, the deeper the depth of field of your vision, which means it's easier to focus. Now, if you're in your 20s or 30s, this will be completely meaningless to you. But as your close vision declines in your 40s and beyond, this is a big deal. I found I only needed reading glasses at work at first because I was using this really cruddy HP laptop plugged into a 10-year-old Apple display that was well past its prime, and it was so dark it didn't light up and make my pupils contract. I'd come home to my beautiful 27-inch Apple Cinema display, and my eyes would focus much more easily. So anyway, a brighter screen to me is a better thing. Now, I'm very happy about the reduced size of the new MacBook Pro. It's 14% thinner, has 20% less volume, and is a half a pound lighter at 4 pounds. That's 11% for anybody who's counting. So 11% lighter as well. Now, my MacBook, 12-inch MacBook is only 2 pounds, so the MacBook Pro is still going to feel like a beast, but every little bit helps. Heck, Steve's MacBook Air feels really heavy compared to my MacBook. I hate to say that. I also like that there's a new form factor for no other reason than it's new, you know? You know how they change a perfectly functional car's external design just to be different from the previous year? The same thing applies to computers for me. Everyone has gray? Let's make them black and charge extra. Black is common? How about white? Oh, white is hard to make? Let's call the new color space gray to get them to buy it again. Yep, take my money. And finally, there's the touch bar. Or I'm sure it's touch bar, not the touch bar, right? Well, anyway, in the demos, they showed how developers could create contextual functionality in touch bar, which looked pretty cool. I was really glad to see a demo of Photoshop with touch bar, even though I'm not a Photoshop user myself. I heard them say Affinity Designer was going to have touch bar support, but I didn't hear Affinity Photo for some reason. I'm hoping that they will. But if you didn't see the demo, it was pretty cool. The woman had her finger on a slider that was on touch bar, and she was changing the size of a brush in Photoshop real time with touch bar. So that was pretty cool. Now, demos are great, but what are the developers saying about touch bar? AgileBits, makers of 1Password, are super excited about touch bar in the integrated Touch ID. They did a blog post with a little video showing how Touch ID on a laptop could open your vaults just like on iPhone. Now, that's magic right there. I actually use my iPhone for banking because it's so much faster to use Touch ID than to type in my long password. AgileBits also created some screenshots of their first ideas of how Touch Bar could mutate while you're using 1Password. I guess the word's adapt, but I like mutate better. Imagine being able to flip vaults with the with Touch Bar or drag a slider on that OLED screen to change generated password lengths. I'll let you read the article yourself. Of course, there's a link in the show notes, but their enthusiasm got me even more excited that developers are going to adapt and adopt the Touch Bar into their applications. Now, one question a few people have asked on Twitter, including Buddy Brannon, is how will Touch Bar be accessible to the blind? Now, it's not a big leap to see that Apple could make it as accessible as the iPhone and iPad screens, but there's one problem. In order to turn on VoiceOver on a Mac to make it accessible, you have to hit Command F5. Well, if F5 is a visual button and not physical, how do you find it without sight? Well, a great resource for the blind is the website AppleViz, and of course they have the answer. They reported that Apple has confirmed that Touch Bar will be accessible, and to enable or disable VoiceOver on Touch Bar-equipped MacBook Pro devices, you hold down the Command key and triple tap the Touch ID button. So, they've got it all figured out. Now, bottom line is, I think there's a lot to be excited about in the new MacBook Pros, and I'm super excited to try it out in November when they get into our grubby, hot little hands. We used to take advertising here over at the Podfeet Podcast Network. I just made that up. Anyway, but a while ago, I stopped using ads in favor of a couple other methods. If you find value in the show and you can afford it, you could pledge an amount for each No Silicast that I publish. We do this through a service called Patreon, and you can sign up at podfeet.com/Patreon. I want to give a big shout out to our newest patrons. I'm not sure if this is Jamie or Jaime Harris, Doug Ingram, Ricky Rodriguez, and Desmond for their support of the show. Now, if you haven't got extra change lying around, I totally understand that. As the holiday shopping season is upon us, though, you're probably going to do some shopping at Amazon, right? If you could go to podfeet.com first and click on the Amazon logo in the left sidebar to get to Amazon, then a small percentage of what you spend will go to help the show, and it won't cost you an extra dime. I really appreciate everyone who's used the American Amazon store as well as the ones for the UK, Germany, and Canada. You can find all of the Amazon links over at podfeet.com/funwithflags. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. I think it's, I know it's my favorite time of the week. I think a lot of other people feel the same way. How are you doing today, Bart?
I am doing fine. It's first day of, well, second day of a week's leave, which is always nice.
So I didn't know you had a week off. Nice.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we have a bank holiday here because it's Halloween on Monday, and I had 4 days leave left, and I went, bank holiday plus 4 days leave equals whole week off. I'll
10
do that.
Days. Nice, nice, best.
No, not 10.
10? No, one, seven, nine.
Nine. Well, is it? Oh, goodness.
Four yeah, okay. buys you nine. That's a good investment right there.
Yeah, I'll take it. I'll take it. Absolutely.
All right. What's okay. on the radar this week?
We have a lot. We have two security mediums, or do we call them media? And then we have a bunch of stories. And at the very end, I decided to stick it in at the start of suggested reading. I have some more follow-up on the whole IoT DDoS mess.
Oh, good.
And it's not really new facts. It's more interesting opinion. And that's why I stuck it in suggested reading. I figured this is not actually new developments. It's continuing fallout from the developments we've already spoken about. So that is, to me, suggested reading rather than a new story.
Yeah.
So let's start with our first bit of security medium. Of course, nowadays you have to give a bug a cool name or it will not be considered a real bug. Mm-hmm. So the bug in question is called Dirty Cow, and the cow is in all capitals.
Okay.
Because the feature... Okay, so this is a bug in the Linux kernel, and the feature that the bug is in is a feature called copy on write, mm-hmm. which is abbreviated to cow, hence Dirty Cow. So... copy on write is a really interesting technique for optimization. So if you have something, say it's a file, say it's a chunk of memory, it doesn't really matter what it is. If you have some chunk of data and you tell the kernel you want a copy of it, the optimization is that it's just marked as the fact that there is a copy, but until someone changes the original, there's never an actual copy made. It's just a pretend copy. And then as soon as there is a write, then it gets bifurcated into the original and the copy. So hence it's copy on write. So until you write, we just, I'll give the same thing two names and that'll be fine because...
So that saves disk space? Waste of energy.
That saves whatever it is you have. So if it's copy on write in RAM, then it saves RAM space. If it's copy on write on a disk, then it's saving disk space. Okay. Copy on write shows up all over the place. It's a very common concept. Snapshotting uses copy on write. So there's a feature in Linux now where you can say, take a snapshot of this entire hard disk the way it is now as a backup. And that snapshot takes like milliseconds to create. So you basically have a backup of your entire disk in milliseconds. But it's not really a backup. You just marked it as, I want to take a snapshot in time. And then as soon as there's a write operation, then a copy is made of only what needs to be changed. And that gives you all sorts of really cool features. So that's how ZFS and stuff like that works. All these fancy pants modern file systems that have changes built in. So copy and write is a really cool feature. And it's all over the place in modern operating systems. Now, in the Linux kernel's implementation of copy on write, there's something called a race condition. And a race condition happens if the outcome of some action may be different if two pieces of code end up running too close to each other. So if you hammer at it, sometimes the wrong thing will happen. So the way you trigger this vulnerability is basically by hammering away with the copy on write feature until it accidentally writes to the wrong piece of RAM. Oh. And in so doing, you end up actually with root privileges.
Oh.
And the scary thing is it takes about 5 seconds to get yourself root privileges. It's an exceptionally reliable exploit.
Ooh.
So, right, yeah. Okay, so what this is a privilege escalation from any user account to root in about 5 seconds in any version of Linux that has been around for the last 9 years.
Oh my gosh. Why is this security medium? Well, it's not light. We know that.
Right. Well, yeah, but there is a fix, right? So, okay. But no, the reason it's medium is because I can't put it in a bullet point. Right? This does not fit as any one bullet point in the show notes. Therefore, it gets... So
that's pretty much more than half of the servers that run the internet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's all over the servers. It's going to be all over the IoT. The IoT is going to be full of this problem. It's all over Android.
So,
because Android runs on the Linux kernel.
I'll make fun of Android in just a minute, but let me make fun of IoT first. Why IoT devices? Are they running embedded Linux in general?
Vast majority of them are. So this is the Linux kernel. So this is the one bit of Linux that everything Linuxy has, right? Mm. I mean, these IoT devices may not have the ls command and all the fancy pants stuff you're used to, but they have to have the kernel, because without a kernel, you don't have an operating system. Right, so the kernel is...
Other embedded operating systems, like I always get confused, is it Green Hills or Wind River? One of those is an embedded operating system that's in things like the full duplex telephones everybody uses.
There's lots of embedded operating systems. So Linux, there is an embedded version of Linux, which would have this problem.
Okay.
And then there are embedded operating systems that are not Linux, which will obviously not have this problem.
Okay. I mean, okay. All right, just that it's embedded doesn't mean it's Linux. Got it. Okay, so now moving on. Now, it's also in the kernel of...
Before we move too far on, so let's just say, right, so this is a privilege escalation vulnerability. So on the one hand, that means that this is not enough to get you into a remote system. So I could have, say, an IoT device that has this bug. This bug on its own will get me nothing. However, this bug turns just about any other bug into I get full root access now.
Super bug.
So if you find any sort of code execution bug in anything, well, now you can leverage that into a full exploit. So this is a really helpful tool to attackers, but it's not enough on its own.
So let's say you had a device that had the hard-coded SSH username and password. Well, I guess you maybe wouldn't need this if you had that.
You probably wouldn't need this because that generally is root privilege straight away. Right. Yeah, so in that case, this is needless. But let's say there's some sort of silly bug in a DNS resolver or something, and you can cause the bind process to execute arbitrary code. Normally, that would not be a problem because bind is run at a ridiculously low privilege, which has access to almost nothing on a Linux system because historically the DNS system was a bit... 20 years ago, DNS was a terrible source of exploits. It's completely different now. But anyway, historically speaking, DNS and NTP were terrible. So those run in a Linux system as the user nobody, and they have basically no rights. So if you do find a bug in an old version of DNS sitting on an old IoT device somewhere, well, now you can turn that otherwise useless bug into I now have full root access. Because nobody can become root in
That's
5 seconds.
That's awesome.
Isn't it? Yeah.
So there is a fix,
and it's
though.
Reliable. There is a fix. So the Linux kernel has been patched. And in fact, this is the second time they're patching it. The first time it was patched by Linus Torvalds himself, but his attempted patch caused a problem on some arcane system somewhere, and they ended up backing it out because at that stage, the exploit was considered theoretical rather than practical. And now researchers have found a way to make it practical instead of theoretical.
Okay. So there's a second
patch. So the Linux, the official Linux kernel is now patched, but that has to make its way to everyone else. So it took Red Hat a few days to get it into the Red Hat kernel, and Debian and everyone, they've all been getting it into the kernel. So if you have a desktop Linux OS, you've probably gotten a kernel update in the last few days, and if you install it, you're fine. And so that's going to take the servers and the desktops out of the way pretty easily, because just about everyone is going to patch their stuff for a desktop on a server. But it's, again, those IoT devices are the tough ones, because who's going to, you know, you don't get firmware updates for these buggy things. So that means this bug is just never going to be fixed in an awful lot of these devices. And then the other issue is Android.
They could be fixed. It's just that these companies don't take it seriously and do that kind of thing. I mean, like I've mentioned several times, my Ring video doorbell can patch itself.
Yes, I mean, the Ring is an example of IoT done very conscientiously. It's a rarity, and it's lovely to see, and one hopes everyone copies the concept. But anyway, I mean, router firmware is updated all the time, but the actual routers in the real world almost never get updated.
Yeah, you have to think of to go look for it.
Yeah, I mean, the Apple ones probably get applied a little bit more because they blink orange at you and people don't like orange flashy lights. It makes them think there's something wrong, which is an appropriate thing to think in that case.
I have to admit, I didn't notice mine blinking until my father-in-law told me his was blinking. I went, hey, look in there. Mine is too. I never look at it.
Mine is sitting next in my technology area where the network printer and the network file store and all that stuff is together. And I like to have a regular look to make sure all the lights are green. Because that means the printer is happy, the file server is happy, and the internet is happy.
My printer's never been happy, but that's a whole nother story.
Okay. Oh, my HP needs to be turned on, off and turned on again about once a week because it forgets the printer.
I'm on a ready for a big rant on this topic. I was thinking about it the other day. I can talk to my grandson Forbes over FaceTime while I'm on a walk outside of my house, but I still can't print.
When it works, my HP works really well. But sometimes it just decides, no, I'm not being a printer today. It just It the signal doesn't even, like, the network cable is in the back of it and the blinky lights are blinking, but the little OS on the printer is oblivious.
Yeah.
And it never comes onto the screen that there's data coming in. And as far as the computer is concerned, the printer is not answering. So it just basically has gone on holidays. So it's just gone, no.
Thank you. So it's not just me. It's my favorite phrase now I started saying is the printer is a lie.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, like cake is a lie in the, yeah. In the portal. Or,
Yeah. I mean, I can see my HP printer. It finds the printer. It says, this is the type of printer it is. Do you want to print to it? Yep. Silence.
Well, mine is slightly different. Mine just vanishes from the network. It just ceases to answer in any way. And OS 10 just says, nope, that printer's not there. And I'm looking at it going, it's on. And I click on the little printer and I go into the thing and I say, what's your IP address? And it has the right IP address. It thinks it's on the network. It's just not actually listening to the real actual network. And so if you turn it off and turn it on again, it suddenly realizes it's a printer and all is well again. That's what I do. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
So Android.
Android.
So Android has a Linux kernel in it. And as of this minute in time, or at least as of when I wrote the show notes yesterday, it has not been patched yet. And the earliest we can expect it to be patched, apparently, is next month's monthly Android update.
Why wouldn't they do this one quickly? Seems rather important. Okay.
It does seem rather important, but we have no... They could surprise us, but apparently the expectation in the industry is that it will happen in next month's patch.
So, but now, that's only for the phones that have...
That get the patch. Right, which is always the problem with Android, right? Now, the Pixel is telling us that maybe there's a chance that the iOS-style patching is the future for Android. I am desperately hoping that becomes true over the next couple of years.
So I hope that Leo Laporte has been saying something lately that he's decided to not recommend any Android devices where the companies haven't committed that they are going to patch when Android gets a patch. And so he said the only two devices I can recommend, as much as it kills me, is the Pixels and Nexuses and Samsung. And now he's like, okay, great. Now, I can't recommend Samsung.
Yeah.
Hopefully more other companies. I mean, what is it? OnePlus has some terrific phones. There's a couple of real great.
They just need to commit. Like OnePlus people really need to commit to doing the software updates because their hardware is actually very interesting.
Right. And they could take Samsung's lunch right now. If they did that, I think it could help.
Yeah. Don't go on fire would be a good start. Then.
Yeah. Step one, don't catch on fire. Step two. Patch.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Is this worse than stage fright for Android?
It's different because, again, it's a privilege escalation. So this does not give someone just carte blanche. Like, stage fright was extra bad because all you had to do was receive an MMS message and then you were hacked.
Okay.
So that got you from process this PNG, or sorry, not PNG, MPEG, process this MPEG to phone completely owned.
Mm-hmm.
This is... The biggest problem I can see for Android from this is that any app can now become malicious in an instant because any app can become root in 5 seconds.
Hmm.
So any app you install from anywhere has the ability to take over your machine. Okay. Any bug in any app has just become a rooting of your device. So if someone writes a sloppy app and someone discovers that it's a sloppy app, they can then root your phone.
So
that is the danger.
Bad in
Every
a different
bug,
way, but equally bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big deal. So it is important that when Google put this update into Android, it's important that you have a phone that can take that update.
Yeah.
Because you really do want that update. Because right now, rooting your phone is trivial. Far too trivial. Scarily trivial.
Okay.
So that's where we are. Links in the show notes. There's a good initial reporting from Ars Technica. I've linked to a nice explanation of the actual intricacies of the bug itself. So if you want to understand how it is that this bug actually works, there's a nice write-up from Naked Security. And then there's a discussion on the whole Android implications from Ars Technica as well. So they're the three links in the show notes. So Security Medium 2 is another named bug. This one is called Drammer, which is short for a double row hammer.
Hmm.
So row hammer is a named bug we came across a year and a bit ago, I think. And so people have been... Okay, so the concept of row hammer is... It's an unusual bug. It's not a software bug. Row hammer is a hardware bug.
Hmm.
So RAM chips contain little physical things that hold the ones and the zeros of what is in memory on your device. And those little physical things are laid out in rows. And in theory, they should be entirely electrically isolated from each other in such a way that what you write into one row should never affect what happens in another row. But some types of RAM, if you write very aggressively into one row, the EM interference or whatever is so strong that it starts to affect the electrons in the row next to it.
Oh,
and
really?
You can actually flip bits by hammering away on a row of data.
Predictably?
Predictably.
Oh.
And so if you then know something about the OS, you can grant yourself root privilege by hammering the row next to a row that is technically not writable by you, but which contains some sort of important information that will grant you root privileges.
Okay, and so that's if you know really the OS, cool, actually. You got to admire that one.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Rowhammer has been around, and people. So the concept of Rowhammer was demonstrated a while ago, and at the time it was basically a case of, we now know how to flip bits within memory, and what to do with that we haven't figured out yet. But since then, of course, all security researchers have been working on ways of arranging things so that stuff you want to attack is in a place in memory that you know, and that you can assign yourself the memory in the row next door. And then your unprivileged app can do something to the privileged app's memory. So you have to do all sorts of jiggery-pokery to get all the pieces lined up in such a way. Basically, you're doing sort of a bit of RAM feng shui to make sure everything is lined up just right. And then you can hammer away at your rows and affect something you shouldn't be able to affect. And the attacks have been evolving over time, becoming ever more reliable. Well, someone thought, well, Android devices, many of them contain RAM chips. And in fact, they contain the type of RAM chip that is potentially vulnerable to this. So they started to experiment with Rowhammer on Android. And what they needed in order to get their end result was to attack one row of RAM from both sides.
Ah, there's where the double part comes in?
Yeah, exactly. So the row you want is in the middle, and you need to control the two sides of it, and then you hammer away at those two rows, and then you get to control what's in between those two rows.
Can I ask a dumb question?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you attack one row of RAM with software?
You write to the memory address, right? So every piece of physical RAM is mapped to a logical address space.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that.
The mapping is not linear, right? One of the things you have to figure out is, okay, so what is the mapping between logical address space and physical address space? And that will depend on the architecture. It will depend on the operating system, which is why this attack has to be reimagined so often. So people have figured out a way to reliably in Android figure out what logical address matches what physical row on the RAM chip.
So why would this only affect Android, though, if it's a straight hardware bug? That should be possible on the iPhone.
Okay, but no one has done... Well, it depends on the type of RAM they have installed. Because it's not all types of RAM. It is certain types of RAM that are vulnerable to this.
I thought everybody used the same kind of RAM, so...
No. Not everyone is using DRAM. And if you have ECC RAM, it's completely unaffected because the error correction will completely stop this kind of thing from happening. Basically, dynamic RAM has to refresh itself every so often. And normally the RAM decays at a certain rate, so the electrons leak out anyway. And so every N milliseconds, you just rewrite everything to RAM to deal with the fact that it's actually quite leaky. And Rowhammer means that it actually leaks away too quickly and it doesn't get properly refreshed. So if you're not relying on that kind of dynamic RAM, then this is completely irrelevant to you. And different manufacturers of RAM will have different effects. And again, the different operating system will change the mapping from physical rows to logical address space. So you have to reinvent the attack for every different operating system. So someone has now invented a Rowhammer attack for Android.
Okay. Say they couldn't do it for the iPhone. We don't know. We just don't know. Okay.
I don't know. Right. I don't know.
So this one seems pretty obscure, too. Like, a little less lie awake at night.
No. Because, someone has done the hard geekery. The hard geekery has now been done. This attack can now be used to root Android phones reliably. Now, not all phones, because it depends on hardware. So, to quote the researchers, DRAMer has successfully rooted the following handsets. The Nexus 4, the Nexus 5, and G4. From LG, the Moto G models from 2013 and 2014 made by Motorola, the Galaxy S4, the Galaxy S5, and the one from OnePlus One. Sorry, from OnePlus, so the OnePlus One. In some cases, the results aren't always consistent. For example, only 12 of the 15 Nexus 5 models were successfully rooted, while only one of the two Galaxy S5s were compromised. The researchers aren't certain why the results are inconsistent. They theorize that the age of a given device may play a role, since extended or intensive use may wear down the cells inside the memory chips over time. So basically, they become more and more leaky the longer you've had the phone, and then they become leaky enough to get row-hammered. And another possibility is that memory chips from some suppliers are more resilient to row-hammer than others, because it's not uncommon for different generations of the same model to actually have different chips from different manufacturers in it. So, like, some of those phones listed are serious, and the result is this hard work, this real low-down nerdery, has resulted in a pretty reliable way of routing these devices if they have vulnerable RAM. And these particular models do have vulnerable RAM. So this is actually serious if you own one of these devices. And what makes it extra serious is that there's no such thing as a software patch for a hardware problem. These devices have RAM that can be hammered.
So how would someone attack? I'm holding my LG G4 in my hand, and I'm surfing the web. Somebody can start addressing the RAM. How? I got no leap from. Do I click on a link? Do I download something?
You go to a web page because they've figured out how to get JavaScript to do it on Android.
Okay. So what if navigate away from that web page? Does it stop?
As long as you're on the page, the hammering is going on. If they succeed in hammering within the five, you know, if it takes them 15 seconds and you stay there for 15 seconds, then your phone is rooted. If you leave just before the memory leaks, then you're not rooted.
So do we know it's 15 seconds?
I don't off the top of my head. And it probably will vary from device to device. And it might even vary depending on how new your device is.
Yeah, that still makes it a little hard to lie awake at night.
If I owned a device like this, I'd be getting a new one.
Really?
Instantly. Oh, yeah. Sorry, if I owned one of those listed devices.
So you also have to go to that website.
But not that website. I mean, anyone can put this out there and attack you. It could be in an app. It could be anywhere. The apps have embedded HTML. And the fact that this can be done by just, like, someone could put this in a web ad.
Yeah, the ads are,
As long as the internet is full of ads, anything that says the word JavaScript instantly becomes, it's everywhere. I mean, no, this is serious, and you can't patch a hardware bug.
Yeah.
This is basically fundamental to the device. So if someone comes out with one of these that works successfully against the iPhone 6, I have a problem.
Yeah.
Hasn't happened yet. And
well, you've been wanting that 7 Plus anyway.
Yeah. An excuse. What if the 7 Plus gets it and not the 6? Anyway. So this is, you know, on the one level, on a nerdy level, the fact that we have figured out how to use the fact that if you write enough to this one row of memory, you can flip the bits in the row next to it to turn that into a useful, reliable exploit to give you root access is bloody cool. The computer science here is amazing.
That's impressive stuff. Sometimes you got to do a tip of the hat, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I'm well impressed with the engineering here. This is good stuff. And ultimately, people are going to have to redesign the RAM to be aware of Rowhammer. It's just going to be one of those things when you're developing a new type of RAM chip, one of the things you will be doing in the lab is Rowhammering it to see how susceptible your chip is. And I imagine that newer chips, once you start testing for it, are just not going to be susceptible. So this is probably going to be a transient problem with a generation of RAM, and then the next generation won't be vulnerable to it.
I just read on Ars Technica, I just was still curious about whether an iOS device could have that. And according to Van der Veen, quoted by Ars, it says, Drammer shows the requirements for a reliable exploitation are provided by fundamental operating system functionality. And I expect that similar functionality is available on iOS or even Windows Phone.
Yeah, I suspect.
Yeah, they haven't. Until someone does it, they haven't done it yet. But we, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it means that they're not sure it's not possible.
Yeah, I just want to know when to be smug and not smug, right?
I wouldn't go being smug on this one. It's a hardware issue, and Apple don't make their own RAM. They may make their own CPUs, but they don't make their own RAM.
Yeah, I don't think they make their own CPUs either, do they? Oh, on iOS they do. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, all of that is our mediums. So let's get into the normal, plain old security update news. Apple have been very busy. Apple have patched macOS to 10.12.1, which is also then simultaneously released security update 2016, sorry, typo in the show notes there. 2016-002 for OS X El Capitan, and also security update 2016-006 for OS X Yosemite.
So it didn't go back further than Yosemite?
No, but actually this is further back than I was expecting Apple to go. I thought they might do El Cap and leave it at that. So this is three versions of OS X that got patched.
Well, they usually go back two, don't they?
Yeah, usually it's the current and one back. This is the current.
Oh, I thought it was current and two back. Okay.
No, this is I'm impressed with Apple in this case. iOS 10.1 also came out, full of security updates and functionality updates, but also security updates. iOS 10.1 includes a fix for a nasty bug which could allow a device to be taken over by rendering a JPEG image, which is comparable to stage fright. The big difference to stage fright being it's trivially easy to patch. So update your iOS devices. That's an important one.
Good.
tvOS has gone to 10.0.1, watchOS has gone to 3.1, and Safari has gone to 10.0.1, all of which are security updates. And finally, Adobe have released a critical update to Flash.
What is it? Ken Ray calls it update a go-go.
Yeah, pretty much update a go-go.
Every single device. I'm always amazed at the updates. Steve always knows about them before I do. He'll just go, oh, really? You're on 10.0.2? I'm on 10.1. Yeah. And it's like, how did you see that? I don't know. He gets them ahead of me. It makes me crazy.
That's pretty because he's on Reddit or something.
Yeah, you know how he is.
Yeah, Steve did do a chit-chat all about Reddit, didn't he? I'm not imagining that.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he's a crazy Reddit guy.
Yeah, so that's where he's getting all his news from.
All right, fine.
Important security news. The U.S. Department of Justice acquired a search warrant which granted them the right to force everyone in a residence or in the vicinity of that residence to press their finger onto the fingerprint sensor on their phones. This is being widely criticized as a spectacular abuse of power and probably a flagrant breach of the Fourth Amendment, which protects Americans from unreasonable search and seizure. And needless to say, it is getting massively criticized by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I don't think this is the last we've heard of this, because if this becomes a new tactic, it will certainly be fought against.
So the first time when I read this and I heard about it, I thought it was a regurgitation of what we had already known, which is they can ask you to put your fingerprint on even if they can't ask you for a password, because a password's in your head and your fingerprint is like your DNA. So I thought that's what that was, but that's not what this is. This is where they just said, okay, anybody in this apartment building, you might have something to do with this. And that's kind of against what we're supposed to be able to do.
Right, because in theory, when you give a warrant, you're supposed to be really specific. You're supposed to be able to tell the judge exactly where you're going and exactly what you expect to find. It's not supposed to be a fishing expedition. The Fourth Amendment protects Americans from fishing expeditions. And this is awfully like a this sounds awfully like a fishing expedition. Now, bits of it were redacted, so maybe there's something in there to justify in the bits we the public can't see. But it seems like an overreach by the federal government. So yeah, we shall see how that develops.
It is being challenged, though, luckily.
Yes. Apple are suing a company called MobileStar for selling dangerous counterfeit power adapters and charge cables through Amazon. And this is a really big deal, because Amazon will list these devices as being Apple chargers, because they're counterfeit. That's what it means to be counterfeit. So if you buy what looks like a genuine Apple charger from Amazon, it could be fulfilled by anyone, including these MobileStar people. And if they're fulfilling it, then the chances are what you are getting is a dangerous knockoff that could kill you.
Bart is not exaggerating in any way, shape, or form. I saw a breakdown of the electronics in one of these a while ago, and it was just appalling. The sloppiness of the physical way they put it together could easily cause it to short out and catch on fire. I mean, power is just, you just don't want to mess with that.
One of the biggest rules in this kind of device is that there should be a certain physical distance between the high voltage circuitry on one side and the low voltage circuitry on the other. Because if you're in a slightly moist environment, like it's a foggy day or something, then it's easier for something to jump the air gap. And if that gap isn't X amount of millimeters, you are in danger. And in a lot of these things, they are like half or less of the required legal safe gap between high voltage circuits and low voltage circuits. They're also missing all sorts of bits and bobs that's supposed to protect you from basically being killed.
Yeah. So when I first read this, I thought that Amazon was the reseller on those, but I misread it completely. So if I said this out loud to anybody or on Twitter or anywhere, I know I was incorrect in an email thread I was in. But this is definitely not Amazon selling it direct. I thought it was Amazon selling it direct as the reseller.
Yeah, no, it's no. So then it's Amazon are mildly more in the clear than you might have thought. Because of the way Amazon do things, it will be listed as a genuine Apple charger. So as a customer, it will be very hard to tell these apart. So Amazon are not. Yeah, Amazon are not completely not to blame, but they're also not to blame.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. But the point being, if it looks too good to be true, it probably is. Is where we come back to. Like, why is this charger half the price of what Apple charge? Possibly because it's bogus. just a sort of a follow-up, I guess, in a story that's made us cranky a lot over the last couple of years. It's good news. One of the people behind the nude celebrity photo theft has been sentenced to 18 months in jail. So just because a crime happens on the internet doesn't mean it's not a crime. You will go to actual real jail, not pretend jail.
So was this the one where everybody said iCloud was hacked, but it wasn't? It was actually people with where their passwords were stolen? Or passwords
were either guessed? The passwords were stolen or their security questions were too honest.
Right. Okay.
And if you're a celebrity, then where did you go to school and all those kind of things? That's what's in celebrity magazines. So security questions are particularly terrible security for celebrities.
You mean so I shouldn't have the name of my dog be my security question?
Right, yeah, even people like us who podcast, we give away much too much about ourselves, like the fact that you have dogs named after cars and or scientists, mm-hmm. and cats named after computer scientists.
Right.
That makes security questions really dangerous for you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've thought about that often because frequently one of the questions I'm offered is, what was the type of your first car? Okay, Bart, you have never been to the United States. Well, look at that. Bart knew the answer to my security question. That's why I use XKPassWD to just make up glop to slap in there, and then I copy and paste those down. Or I just make up really funny answers that have nothing to do with the question. So that's entertaining too. But put it in one password so you can remember what it is.
Yeah, lie and then note down your lies.
And I want to do a little illustration of how a lot of the things Bart has taught us about over the years is really coming to the forefront in the news right now. No matter what your political affiliation, this is still an interesting lesson. The hack of the Democratic convention's emails, I just read today, happened because the main guy that they've been leaking all the emails, WikiLeaks been leaking the emails from, got an email that said, oh, your password's been hacked. You need to reset your password. Someone who worked for him sent it over to their security guy who said, this is legitimate. He should change his password immediately. Sent it back to him and he clicked the link.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I knew it was spear phishing. I didn't read into that level of detail. Oh, dearie me.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So don't click links that then ask you to put your password in.
Yep.
No.
Yep. Absolutely. So, the good news there is that the campaign people were like, we should get this checked out by security people. The fact that they hired an idiot is a different problem, but they weren't at least aware of it.
Or he wasn't more specific in how he should reset his password. That too, right?
Right. Yeah, that's true. Actually, go directly to URL. Do not click on any link. Yeah.
Oh, and the URL, the article was actually a little stupid, too. The URL was something like reset my Google password dot secure passwords dot net. Oh, something Jesus. Like it was like it wasn't even close to what you would do.
Yep.
All right. Moving on.
Yeah. So exactly. That's a good lesson. Is spear phishing real? Yep. There it is. Anyway. Google have quietly dropped their ban on personally identifiable web tracking. So Google have been using sort of don't panic too much about the fact that we track everything you do online. We don't actually track it to you, the person. We just track it to some sort of random number that happens to be associated with you. So we're not really tracking you. We're just tracking this anonymous identifier. Yeah, well, they've sort of changed the rules and now they can track you, the person, if they want. And this is just... companies will follow the incentives of their business model. This was always the incentive of Google's business model. This doesn't surprise me in the slightest, and I don't think it should come as a surprise. It's just the inevitable next step for a company whose business model is selling people's privacy. This is why me, of all people, is becoming a massive Microsoft fan. Because Satya Nadella wants to sell me software as a service. I'm happy to buy software as a service.
As opposed to selling
me devices. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Apple wants to sell me devices. I'm happy to buy devices.
And Satya Nadella is writing that software to work on your Apple devices. It all fits.
Really well.
Yeah.
Sometimes better on my Apple devices than on the Windows Phone devices that some of my Microsoft fan friends use. And they're very cranky about the fact that I have a better Microsoft client than they do.
It's got to kill
them. Which is funny in many levels. But, you know, market forces, again, there are more iOS devices, so therefore it's better for Microsoft to support iOS first, which is weird. But there we go. So it's not a good news story, but it's not shocking to me. So, you know, there it is. Mm. The U.S. Federal Communications Commission, better known as the FCC, have issued some long-awaited rules on how ISPs can use the data they gather about their customers. Being where they are, being your gateway to the internet, they are in a very privileged position and they can tell an awful, awful lot about you. So they obviously have a lot of information they could, in theory, sell. And they want to sell it because they'd like to charge you for internet and sell you as well, because then they make twice as much money if they basically double sell things. And the FCC have stepped in with rules. So this is not pure good news, but the rules are actually a lot more strict than a lot of people were expecting, and certainly a lot more strict than what the ISPs wanted. So personally identifiable information, you have to opt in to that being shared.
Oh.
Now, information that's not considered sensitive, and they have all sorts of rules for what is and isn't sensitive, is opt out. And then information that's been anonymized is just theirs to do with as they please.
So this makes me think about when, wasn't Verizon doing something where they said, hey, you can knock $5 a month off your plan if you let us track your personally identifiable information?
Yeah, I mean,
that would be okay, right?
That would be okay, because as long as it's opt in, as long as it's not, unless you tell us not to, we will.
Yeah.
So no, these rules are, they seem like a reasonable balance between corporate interests and user interests. I probably would have liked to see it go a bit more towards users, because my point of view would be, if you're a paying customer, then it's not okay to have your data sold on you as well. Yeah. And I think I don't like this idea of sort of two bites of the apple there, but that's a personal opinion of mine. Finally, ProPublica have shone a light on something which apparently Facebook have been doing for a while. Facebook allow you to target your ads based on race. Or rather, they allow you to exclude certain races from your ad campaign. And America has laws against that kind of thing, one in particular being the 1968 Fair Housing Act, which makes it illegal to advertise a house for sale or for rent in such a way that it will only be shown to people of a certain race, because you had a great big problem with black people being denied access to nice communities. And ProPublica took out an ad for a home on Facebook using Facebook's API, interface. They selected that the ad only be shown to white people. The ad was sent for approval. It was approved. That is a complete breach of the Fair Housing Act.
Huh. You know, I heard some about this, and it got down to an algorithm that would that they had created that would try to figure out who you are towards how you'd be advertised to. And it was Darren Kitchen on Daily Tech News Show was screaming, "Don't blame the algorithm. It was just trying to do its job you told it to do."
You're right. The problem is the very concept. So they're saying, no, this isn't race. This is race affiliation, is a euphemism they've come up with.
Affinity.
Sorry, race affinity. That was it. Race
affinity. Affinity is what they called it.
Yeah, sorry, no, they didn't use the word race. That would not be a good pseudonym. I'm terrible at newspeak. So the very concept of this. So basically, they're using all the information they have about you to determine what race they think you are, and then they're letting advertisers target you based on race. And to me, this is just setting off all sorts of moral alarm bells.
Yeah.
And the fact that they're able to use this to, I mean, how that ad got approved when it is blatantly illegal is astonishing to me.
But it was approved. I'm glad they caught him. So that will stop, I'm sure.
I hope so, because I imagine there are civil rights lawyers going, "Yeah, what? You can do what?" Yeah. If you read the article, actually, they interview a lawyer who's a civil rights lawyer, and it is clear that the man is in abject shock that in 2016 you can you can take out an ad that is only to white people for housing. That is the guy's head is digitally exploding. Yeah, it's amazing.
Hey, can I add one to security light or wait, what is this category called?
Well, notable Important breaches is about news? To begin.
Well, this isn't notable breaches. So you remember we talked about WhatsApp used to protect your privacy, and then they got bought by Facebook, and Facebook said, no, we're not going to share that data with anybody. And then Facebook came back and said, we were just kidding. We're actually going to share that information. The European Commission has a working group called the Article 29 Data Protection Working Party, and they have written to WhatsApp and said, we would like you to stop doing that until we study this.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So we don't have any news yet on what's going to happen. But let's see. The letter signed by the chairman of the group says WhatsApp shouldn't share personal data with Facebook, quote, until the appropriate legal protections can be assured, unquote.
Interesting. We shall see how that develops. I imagine we might hear some more about that over time.
Yeah. Maybe that's under. Oh, you know what? That probably would go under suggested reading.
It would have done, but I didn't.
I'm going to add it. I'm going to add it.
Yeah. Stick it in. Stick it in.
Look at me.
Okay, so notable breaches. So hackery in the U.S. election is a bipartisan affair. It's not only the Democrats getting stuff hacked, different hacks. In the case of the Democrats, it seems to be about emails in an attempt to embarrass people. In the case of the Republican hack, it's about money. The website for the National Republican Senatorial Committee, or the NRSC, has had a credit card stealing malware on it for 6 months. So if you bought a Never Hillary t-shirt or whatever, you probably have your credit card stolen. Which is not good. Anyway, look, that's a notable breach. There we go. Okay. Password reuse has triggered Netflix to send out warnings to users. So this is not a Netflix breach. This is Netflix finding passwords in the wild that are reused from other breaches, checking them against their own database proactively, and then warning their own users that actually you realize that you are using a password on Netflix that is in the wild. Change it now.
Oh.
So this is very positive.
Good, good, good. That's what should be happening, right?
That is what should be happening. So this is Netflix using the breached information to prevent breaches on Netflix effectively. There is also an issue that seems to be coming up, people seem to be suffering from, where they suddenly start getting a whole bunch of Chinese iMessage spam, and it seems to have been traced to password reuse, where people have the same password on their iCloud account that they had on some sort of account that got breached in one of the 20 kabillion breaches that we've had in the last while. So again, there is a reason everyone keeps saying, like a stuck record. Use a unique password. Use a unique password. Use a unique password. Use a unique password. Don't reuse passwords. Finally, just for anyone who uses Adult Friend Finder and was not put off by the last breach of their database, it's happened again. Two different groups have hacked it in the last while, so it's a double breach of the same information. And technically a third breach because it all happened before.
Yikes.
So I think maybe that's probably time to change provider.
Yeah.
Suggested reading. So the first thing I have here is a bunch of stories related to the Mariah, whatever way you pronounce that, botnet. The first link is to Naked Security, where they have a really good takedown of some of the dumb myths that are circulating about this attack. It's well worth reading because people have the wrong idea about some of this stuff, and it's just good to knock that on the head. Also, the Chinese manufacturer of a whole bunch of the devices, Xiaomei, I believe is how you pronounced it last time, so I'll go with that pronunciation. They are being a bit schizophrenic. So they are, on the one hand, accepting the fact that they have a major problem and promising to do a recall. And on the other hand, threatening to sue Brian Krebs and other journalists for reporting on the fact that they have a major problem.
Oh, come
because
on.
Apparently that's defamation. Yeah, they're managing to do both at the same time. Which is amazing. Now, needless to say, Brian Krebs is laughing at them very loudly and publishing their letter rather than giving into this kind of carry on. And something that a couple of people have noted, particularly John Gruber has been talking about it on his podcast and on his website, and also iMore have an article about it. But a lot of people are now looking back at about a year ago, there were a lot of stories about the fact that HomeKit wasn't getting a lot of adoption, and there were a lot of interviews with manufacturers saying, oh, it's so hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, Apple, make us do security. And now when you look back with what has happened now, and then you go, actually, thank goodness Apple did not cave to pressure here. Thank goodness Apple held their own and did not reduce the requirements for encryption and so forth on their devices.
So John and Dave talked about this some on the Mac Geek Gab, and Dave has definitely been on the side of it's too onerous and that's why nobody's doing it. And everybody's going to make their stuff work with something like the Amazon Echo so that they don't have to do these onerous things. And when this, you know, after this attack happened, he still maintains that it's still too onerous and that manufacturers will want to still write to some or create devices that work with the Amazon Echo, even if they were to make them work with with HomeKit. But it seems to me Apple doesn't require a proprietary chip or proprietary technology. They just require that there be hardware encryption. So you could put hardware encryption in and have that device work insecurely over on an Echo until Amazon implements secure encryption.
But what
right?
will be the point? What will be the point of having a device?
Because they can sell more devices. So I'm making a widget here that's gonna feed my cat. I make it with the hardware encryption so that it'll work with HomeKit, but that device could also work with something insecure like an Echo.
But is the Echo incapable of security?
No. I'm just saying if Amazon doesn't implement hardware encryption requirements, you could make it where it worked for both.
Right, but there's a difference between a requirement and support. So if Amazon supports security but don't require it, and Apple requires security, what you actually will end up with is devices that are always secure on both.
Yeah, I don't know about Amazon, and I don't know what their plans are or anything about that. But I don't understand why Dave is still saying it's not. I don't know. I would really like to talk to a manufacturer. I've been reaching out to one of them to say, why is this so hard? It doesn't sound hard to me.
It isn't. The technology Apple are mandating is basic is standard encryption stuff. It's not esoteric weirdo stuff.
So many companies at CES said we will have HomeKit devices out by blah 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 date, and those companies don't. I mean, there isn't. I haven't checked this.
Okay,
week, but there isn't a webcam that supports hardware encryption. Yeah,
my theory on this is very simple though. Until iOS whatever 10. There was no HomeKit app. HomeKit was this weirdo thing that no one but hobbyists was using.
Ah, right.
So to me, the market started a few months ago.
Yeah. But I mean, these companies said they were going to do it.
Yeah, and then they looked at it and they went, do you know, there's nobody here. And Apple don't seem to be taking this very seriously because there's not even an app on the device.
Yeah. I mean, it was possible to do HomeKit, but I couldn't tell how you would do
it. Yeah, I mean, everyone's experience with HomeKit was, this isn't ready. Basically, this is obscure, this is weird, this is user hostile. So I don't think there was this huge market for HomeKit stuff. So I think the reason that no one built the stuff was because the market wasn't there. But I think now with iOS 10, with this really good native support, where if you swipe up and swipe right, so you get, you know, your volume up and down, you swipe right, you get your what's playing now, you swipe right again, you get your HomeKit. Now that it's actually first-party support right in their flagship OS, now it has a chance. Now, if I was a manufacturer, I would be saying, okay, there are now millions of iPhone owners who I could sell to, but there weren't 6 months ago.
By the way, don't trust Apple to list it correctly. I just did a search for HomeKit webcam just to see if I could find any yet. And I found an Apple site that lists all of the home app automation apps and or devices. One of them is the Canary security systems and cameras. And that's the main company I've been trying to talk to about this. They don't have a HomeKit compatible Canary, and yet it's listed on Apple's website under home automation. That's it's a weird. Separate. There's a filter for HomeKit compatible, and there's nothing under it in the category of webcam.
Huh.
So
interesting.
Yeah. So don't trust Apple to tell you unless you click on that HomeKit compatible one.
Yeah, HomeKit to me is something Apple haven't put nearly enough energy into, and if Apple put energy into it and it fails, I'll be very sad. But so far, I have yet to see Apple even try.
Yeah, I agree.
So we shall see. Anyway. Okay, so that is the suggested reading related to the IoT mess. Some other stuff I thought was worth mentioning. Facebook's bug bounty program turned 5. And therefore, we obviously have an excuse for some statistics. 900 bugs have been squished. And, sorry, there's a million missing from the show notes. They didn't pay out $5, they paid out $5 million.
Oh, okay. This is 5 years old?
Yeah. So that's $1 million a year to security researchers for finding problems in Facebook. That's how bug bounty programs should work. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So I thought that was nice to see. Also, telemetry data from the Firefox browser shows that 50% of pages visited by Firefox users are now secure. So Let's Encrypt is halfway to where it wants to be, which is a fully secure internet.
Hmm. On that note, you know, I've been, you helped me do the HTTPS dance on podfeed.com, and I embed, or I should say Steve embeds the live video feed from the Hangout on Air, and it's Google who's been pushing for HTTPS, right? They've been really out in front pushing that. The Hangout on Air URL is not HTTPS. You can add it, but it's not in it by default.
Okay, so they do support secure. They just assume that most people's websites are insecure, and so their default they hand you is insecure.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Where was I? Oh, yeah. There is a link here I would like you to save and hope you never need it. But if you do, it is a link from Intego, 8 things to do immediately when you've been hacked.
Yikes.
So save a copy.
That's a good one.
Also in the category of really interesting, Ars Technica have been doing this a few times now over the last couple of months, where they write an article explaining how something very common in the security world actually works. So this week they had an article, how SQL injection vulnerabilities work. So you'll often hear them mentioned, but if you want to understand how they actually work, it's a really nice write-up from Ars Technica. It's a two-parter. It's really nicely done. So that link is in the show notes. And obviously, because it's about SQL injection, I could not resist sticking in a link in the show notes to one of my favorite XKCD comics, good old Bobby Tables.
Okay.
So after you've read the Ars article, read the XKCD comic and prepare to laugh, because it's bloody brilliant. And other than that, there's a few other things in there, but they're all bad news. So I'll leave those to the listener's discretion.
All right, so no palate cleanser of joy at the end of this one, huh?
That's the XKCD comic.
Oh,
surely.
There you go. Okay, all right. That's our palate cleanser. All right, Bart. Well, I'm not kidding when I say this is my my favorite part of the No Silicast is getting to listen to you explain this stuff, because it's always in a way we can understand and yet keeps us aware of what we need to know.
Okay, well, thank you. I try. I
know you hate compliments.
I do my best. I don't do compliments. Yeah, it's culturally not acceptable here. Can't say nice things about people to their face.
All right, you stink.
Yay! Okay, well, until next time, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can email me at allison@podfeed.com and follow me on Twitter. Remember, everything good starts with podfeed.com. We've got podfeed.com/Patreon, podfeed.com/Facebook, podfeed.com/Google+, podfeed.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, except not next week, we won't have a live show until November 13th. How do you get there? You head on over to podfeed.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic No Silicastaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.